Ahoy, Vachon. How's the French say, Vachon? This is the Brown Briefly, where less is more, more or less, coming to you live over KVSH 101.9 FM, Voice of Vachon, your island connection. Please make us part of your day. And be advised that our assertions and views, which can modestly be described as progressive persuasion, do not in any way reflect the opinions of KVSH or Voice of Vachon.
Hello, this is the Brown Briefly podcast and weekly radio show coming to you live from Vachon Island, Washington, in the middle of the Salish Sea and radiating from one of the centers of island cultural activity known formally as the Gene Bosch Voice of Vachon broadcast studio in the bustling and bodacious heart of our rapidly changing island community. That was the voice of our founder, Brian Brown. Together, we, the Briefly, strive to keep Brian's bright flame alive by bringing you weekly episodes of intelligent, at least we hope so, discussions of current events laced with humor and empathy and always guided by Brian's mantra of less is more, more or less. Our Briefly panel includes, at our control board this morning, replacing our intrepid Truman O'Brien, who is sick today, is our legal beagle, mediator, Fulbright scholar, shoe salesman. We need to hear more about that at some point. Pinkerton guard and former Washington State Assistant Attorney General Craig Bellis.
Blah, blah, blah.
And more.
I'll tell you about the shoe salesman thing some other time, Bruce.
That's right.
But it's great to be here.
It's good to have you. Also, our part-time Politico, water transit miracle worker, full-time shenanigans coordinator, Amy Dreher.
Good morning. Good morning.
Hey, it's good to have you here, Amy.
Thank you. And I see some sun.
There it is. Yeah. It's peeking through. And thanks for all the work you're doing with the ferry issue down in Olympia.
Yeah,
we all appreciate that.
Busy time.
It is. Also, mariner, backpacker, rocket scientist, and haven't flipped a quad yet, which probably needs some explanation for those people who are not familiar with rowing, because it's not a quad bike, it's a quad shell, right?
It's a quad racing shell, yeah. A quad bike is one thing I've never owned, but you know, who knows what might happen as I go forward. We were out in quads today, actually. It was spectacular flat water.
Oh, beautiful morning.
Yeah, Brian rallied a few hearty souls to get out there now after the big freeze has gone by. We had the serenade of Canadian goose to charm our way, and I believe somebody spotted a bald eagle. Water was mirror flat. Pretty awesome day.
Not bad. And also joining us today is our small talk guest, Dr. David Perley, who I will introduce more fully later. David, good to have you here.
Oh, nice to be here.
Great.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, good to see you again, David. And I'm historian Bruce Hallman. So
that's all you're giving us, huh? You're a
that's
historian.
All you get. in dribbles and drabs, as they say, right? So before we start, let's check in with the Brieflys about their week. So, Amy, tell us about what you've been doing this week, or what haven't you been doing?
Yeah, what haven't I been doing? Let's see. Well, I didn't go to a planned bonfire on Saturday night because of rain. Want.
Nah.
Yeah, I know. But I did go to bingo at the Eagles on Friday night, which was great. I encourage everyone to go. It's great fun. And then, let's see. But in all seriousness, yesterday I was excited to virtually testify for HB 1264 in the legislature. It is a bill to basically redo how the HR, the Washington State HR Department, surveys salaries for our mariners, for our WSF crew, which we hope will bring a lot more parity to the crew and competitiveness with maritime workers overall. And then to preview tomorrow, going to testify for the Mosquito Fleet Act. And I think I've roped Mr. Kevin Jones in on that Mosquito Fleet Act shenanigans coordination, as it were. We're working any way and every way we can to improve the boats and expand water taxi service.
Yeah, Amy, I'm in. Nice. Scraping the bottom of the barrel, but yeah, here I am. I'm going to jump in.
No, you're gonna be the voice of, hey, guys, this is the clean, efficient, green way to do it. Let's go. Let's go to the future.
Hey, great. And we have a really interesting history of the mosquito fleet here on Vashon Island. So sometime it might be interesting to do that as briefly, just to sort of explore what it was and what it can be, because it is the future. Mm-hmm. So, Craig, how about you? What's your week been like?
Well, I had a number of things going on, but the two big ones were probably I went and saw The Brutalist at the Vashon Theater.
All four hours?
Almost. a little exaggeration, but, you know, when was the last time you saw a movie in a theater that had a 15-minute intermission? You know, Lawrence of Arabia, maybe, or Dr. Zhivago.
Lord of the Rings.
Oh, Lord of the Rings, that's right. Something a little more contemporary. Uh-huh. A fascinating movie, and I understand why it was nominated for so many Academy Awards. Lots of different themes. Plus, I've always been kind of an architecture fan, so that whole brutalist form of architecture just fascinates me. Not one of my favorite forms of architecture, but... that was an excellent movie.
It's called that for a reason.
Yes, right? I know. It's right in your face like a blockhouse, you know. The other major event was our absentee, briefly today, Truman O'Brien's birthday party that we went to this weekend. And I wanted to wish Truman another happy birthday.
That's why he's under the weather, so to speak, today.
It's not days long hangover. It's I think he just came down with a really bad cold.
Oh, get well, buddy.
Yeah, he's got reserves. He'll come back strong. So happy birthday, Truman. And that's about it.
Sounds like an exciting weekend. And happy birthday, Truman, if you're listening in. So, David, how about you? What's your week been like?
I've been kind of busy, and I'm recovering from a cold too, so I've kind of got a little bit of a cough. And then this morning we had the electrician came out to change the electrical panel, and he blew my x-ray machine. Can you believe that? I had to get a dental technician to come out this afternoon and see if he could fix it.
Whoa.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Things never stop.
So it's been some morning.
Well, we appreciate you joining us very much. So, yeah. Kevin, how about you? What's up with you?
A couple things. I did go on Saturday. There was a microaggressions workshop at Synergy on the island, which was attended by 25 or so folks who are looking to make our community more friendly, less hostile to each other, and understanding how we can work together in ways that are more inviting and more inclusive. So I thought that was a very good session. Not on Our Islands is a group that has emerged recently, and they were the host and did a fantastic job. So kudos to Jamie for making all that happen. And Jennifer and Julia and Teresa and others who are just part of the team there, who's doing a really wonderful job. Also, the building a progressive majority and the legislative action focus groups of Indivisible Vashon gathered for our 2025 kickoff, kind of who has the energy to work in those spaces. So I expect we'll be hearing more from them. And if you tuned in yesterday on any news station, you maybe saw a rally somewhere in your neighborhood, usually around the Capitol. I want to credit to Ezra Levin for like 2 weeks ago. He's a co-founder of Indivisible Vashon, said, hey, maybe you ought to be checking in with your members of Congress about what's going on in the government right now. And guess what? The day after that, the whole week after that, people followed that guidance. So Indivisible is leading in encouraging people to do that. And then, of course, President's Day is a very sort of appropriate day, you know, to express your opinion about the administration. And lots of folks did. So I was really happy to see that kind of expression of personal concern going
on. Did you make it to Olympia yesterday? Or what's the word from Olympia?
I had some conflicts yesterday. Oh. And my laptop and sort of getting all of our new enthusiastic members sort of attached to different focus groups is taking up quite a large amount of time. So enjoying that work. Also working on looking at the legislative work. We're still creating actions. The legislation is in full swing. So I'm also creating actions for the Environment Climate Group there. So lots of things that keep me tied to the chair here in the den. So, but I didn't get out to a protest.
Ah, sounds good, Kevin. Thanks for the work you do. We appreciate it.
Yes. I am later today, though. Oh, just so you know, Pramila Jayapal's having a town hall in Seattle, and so I'm going to be on the passenger ferry boat at 3:15. If you'd like to go to that and you didn't register, it is jammed full. So I would love to tell people, just go over and drop in, but I don't think that would work. But there will be at least a few people from Vashon there to express some of our concerns about what's happening, and hopefully we'll have some good feedback for you next week.
Ah, fantastic. Thanks, Kevin. My week was, Friday was Valentine's Day, of course, which in my family is very special because one of our grandsons, Holden, was born on Valentine's Day. So it's not only a celebration of family love and all that good stuff, but it's also a birthday for an 11-year-old, which was just, of course, typically wild, a house full of kids and and friends and parties and all that kind of stuff. So it was a great weekend for that. So I really enjoyed it. Also, I've been texting back and forth with my brother-in-law, Mike McQuain, who's a retired Army colonel, helicopter pilot in Vietnam, and not the most liberal guy in the world, but also a patriot. And he and I have just been exchanging text back and forth about what's going on with the government right now and layoffs and the reorganization and Mr. Musk and to find somebody who's sort of, I would consider, a moderate conservative, you know, military background kind of guy, and he's as outraged as I am. So there's some hope here as we move into the future. At least I think there's some hope here. Yeah, Kevin.
You know, Bruce, I'd say if Truman were here, he might amplify this comment as well. Anybody who did anything at all involved with the intelligence community is probably totally at odds with how this administration, first of all, had some Russian, Kislyak in the Oval Office, like right after round one. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, all the hoarding of classified documents and who knows what secrets may have left that facility. And all of the investment we do to be safe with our allies around the world to understand the threats that may be aimed at us. I'm thinking a lot of folks should definitely be up in arms about what's happening and the infiltration of unclassified mm-hmm. folks into those classified areas is not a recipe for good safety and security, in my opinion. But that's just me. Yep.
You know, I'm reluctant to break into and take up a little bit of our guest's time, but I think it's finally starting to come home. The whole thing over in Hanford. And the number of people that were laid off, all of the engineers and the people that deal with the waste and the safety issues, has the newspapers down in the Tri-Cities up in arms. And those are not the most progressive liberal newspapers down there in the Tri-Cities. And they are really upset. So the waves in the pond, I think, are starting to reach out further and further.
Indeed they are. And the same thing when you look at newspapers in the Midwest, the agricultural sort of newspapers, you know, the cutting off of USAID purchases of farm products is, you're talking billions and billions of dollars, and it's starting to impact the heartland in a way that I don't think anybody anticipated. So it'll be an interesting
ride. Well, some
ride.
Of us anticipated.
Yeah, yes, right. Yeah,
yeah. We were like, the find-out portion is going to be tough, guys.
We were out screaming in the desert.
That's right, yes. Yeah. The Jeremiahs of the world, right? Well, let's move on to David and our small talk sort of session. Today, February 18th, is actually the day before tomorrow, which is February 19th, which is the 83rd anniversary of President Franklin D. Roosevelt's Executive Order 9066, which ordered the exile and imprisonment of over 120,000 Japanese Americans in what was identified as a West Coast exclusion zone during World War II. The exclusion zone, if you're not familiar with it, actually just ran from the Cascade Crest in Washington and Oregon, a little bump to cover the Hanford nuclear site, all of California, and a small corner of Arizona. So any Japanese American of Japanese descent living in that area were basically exiled and imprisoned during World War II. Our fellow Americans were imprisoned in what was euphemistically called internment camps, but in reality, they're what FDR himself called the American concentration camps. You know, our small talk today, guest today, David Perley, is a dentist in California, is a descendant of two Vashon Japanese American families, the Sakaharas and the Tanakas, and also who lived on Vashon prior to World War II. So, David, welcome to the Brown Briefly, and sort of two questions to get you started. First, just tell us about yourself. You know, where did you grow up? You know, where did you go to school? What was your experience as a kid, and what led you to become a dentist? And then, secondly, what's your connection with Vashon?
Well, I grew up in Long Beach, California, and I went to dental school at USC. So I had a few relatives who are dentists, so that's how I got involved in it. I have a connection to Vashon because my family used to farm there. And also my brother Eric and his family live in Vashon.
Oh, great. So you have a family connection with the Sakahara and Tanaka families. And then your brother has moved here recently, right, within the last 5-10 years? Is that correct?
Yeah, it's about 10 years. I think you went over to his house for dinner, remember?
Yes, I do. Yeah, right. Yeah, it seems like that not that long ago, but that was when we had just started the Japanese Presence Project, and you came up to visit. So it was really, really nice to meet him.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us a little bit about how you got involved with the Japanese Presence Project, the research project, and how you got interested in researching your own family's history.
I began studying my ancestors because I wanted to gain a deeper understanding of their background. On the Japanese side, they had to overcome many hardships as a result of being incarcerated in concentration camps. And on my other side is Jewish. So they had to overcome numerous challenges also. So way back in 2014, I decided to start researching the Vashon Japanese. And it turned out that, and to try to find somebody on Vashon that was doing it, and it turned out to be you, Bruce, and Alice. Mm-hmm. So I contacted you guys, and you guys let me join the group.
Yeah, and it was a great sort of correspondence of efforts. I often define you, David, as our energizer bunny of research. You are unstoppable. and you just do a great job. But Alice Larson and I in 2011 had gotten a small for culture grant from King County to research the census data. We called it the Census Project, and we ultimately digitized all the Vashon census data up through 1940. We're currently working on the 1950 census data that was just released last year, and then has put it online. So VashonHistory.com, you can go there and you can find all the census data. And in doing that, we just noticed this an amazing sort of growth of a Japanese-American population on Vashon, particularly in the 1920s and 30s, and then how it sort of doesn't disappear but drops significantly after World War II. And as we started that project, we started reaching out, and David got in touch with us. And so we have been researching for almost 10 years now the Japanese-American population on Vashon. So tell us a little bit about the Sakaharas and the Tanakas.
I'll start with the Tanakas. Hatsuguma was my great-grandfather, and he came from Kumamoto, Japan. And he arrived in America around the early 1900s looking for better opportunities. Initially, he worked the railroad. Later, he traveled to Alaska to work in the canneries. during the salmon season. My grandma Pauline told me when I was little that he used to be a horse soldier in Japan. This helped him to flee when the townspeople stormed one of his work sites, since he could dress really fast.
Hmm.
Hatsuguma Tanaka married my grandmother Momoye, a pitcher bride, on June 12, 1912. So do you know how to detect whether someone is a pitcher bride?
No.
It's because she will get married on the same day she arrives in America from Japan.
Hmm.
If the man did not marry his future wife as soon as she arrived, he would be failing to fulfill his marital vows.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, so let me give some a little bit of background. People may not know about pitcher brides, but what happened in the 1880s, there were Chinese exclusion laws, and so the Chinese immigration was cut off. And so what you had is you had Japanese immigration coming in, filling many of the roles that the Chinese had filled in the 1870s and 1880s. So beginning in the 1890s and early 1900s, you have Japanese immigration coming in. And in 1907, the Gentlemen's Agreement essentially cut off the immigration of Japanese males to the United States, but left a kind of quote-unquote loophole in that it did not cut off Japanese women coming in. And so Japanese women could immigrate if they had a husband to marry when they got here. And so they were often called picture brides because it would be marriage sort of brokers, if you will, who would have books of pictures of women looking to be married to Japanese in America. And you would pick your bride from a picture, which happened with other immigrant groups from Norway, from Sweden, from Germany as well. But they're often called picture brides because often the couples had never met until the woman arrived and they married, as you said, David, on the day that they arrived. So that's the concept of a picture bride. David, back to you.
Okay, so my great-grandparents, they only had one child, which was my grandma Pauline. And when she was 3 years old, in 1916, they moved to Vashon. So they were farmers who sold their produce in Seattle. My grandma grew up in a close-knit community that supported one another. She attended many social gatherings to connect with friends and form better relationships with the non-Japanese on the island. She was on a Vashon's girls basketball team and competed in tournaments with other Seattle Buddhist groups. Later, she became the Vashon correspondent for the Japanese American Courier, the first Japanese American newspaper to be published entirely in English. And she covered the happenings on Vashon.
But let me interject here, David. What I found fascinating, you sent me one of her columns, and the name of the column was Voice of Vashon. Isn't that spectacular? So thank you, David.
Yeah, that was a New Year's poem for 1933.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought you guys might want to know that you weren't the first Voice of Vashon.
We do, thank you.
Latest and greatest.
So now I'll talk about Sakaharas. So my great-grandfather, Yatsumatsu, he was born in Osaka, and he also arrived early in the 1900s. He leased 40 acres of farmland in Fife, Washington. In 1907, he returned to Japan and brought his wife back, Yoshino. Later, three of his sons, Yasujiro, Tojiro, and Matachi, immigrated to America. My grandfather, Dan, was born in Fife in 1908, so he was the only one who was an American citizen. In 1919, Yasumatsu, Yoshino, and Dan returned to Japan. My grandfather learned Japanese lacquer art in Japan. And later he returned to America in 1927. He became the manager at the Tacoma Farmers Association, served as the president of the Puyallup Valley JACL in 1937 and 1938, served as a special deputy in Tacoma, and participated in various other groups. So now I want to go into some detail about Dan's nephews, because they kind of accomplished a lot of things. Dan's brother Tojiro had a son, Toru. And Toru became a lawyer and was instrumental in the repeal of the Alien Land Law, which had been placed since 1921 and stopped Asian immigrants from owning land in Washington State. He also brokered the peace for the Black Panthers in Seattle. I think there was a riot. And later on, he helped Japanese immigrants regain their farms and homes. Tojiro's son Hiroshi became a member of the legendary 442nd Battalion, which was the most highly decorated regiment in Army history. While serving, he earned the Bronze Star and became an honorary Texan for rescuing the Lost Battalion, a group of Texas National Guardsmen. Another nephew of his, from his brother Yasujiro Noboru, was wounded in France during World War II and was given 4 bronze medals and a Purple Heart. And then finally, another nephew from Yasujiro, his name was Toshio, was adopted out to Mokutaro Hori. Mokutaro Hori was inducted into Montana Cowboy Hall of Fame. Toshio served in the military intelligence service. So basically, in those days, when someone died, everything was passed to the eldest son. So the other children didn't get anything. So if there were no boys in the family, then you either adopted a boy, or if you had a daughter, you would have the daughter marry someone, and that person would change their surname to their daughter's maiden name. And that way you could pass everything along.
Oh, interesting. That is fascinating. That is. Yeah. So a way to continue family's legacies, but working around not having a firstborn son, if you will. Oh, interesting.
There's so many adoptions from Japan, and that could cause problems trying to trace your family history back, too.
Oh, great. Well, we appreciate that. That's fascinating.
I'm curious, David. This is Craig. I think that Bruce touched upon this a little bit. Was there anything in particular that you primarily relied on to find out all of this information? Was it family members? How did you determine all this detail?
I researched through a lot of ancestry and newspaper websites, and I even applied for records in Japan. And then we had a bunch of old family albums, so I was able to get them digitized on Denjo. And some of them included Buddhist funerals and Buddhist churches in Seattle and Washington area. And also, I was able to get two Tule Lake concentration camp paintings from my family. And actually, those albums were in the basement, and those paintings were in my aunt's basement for like, I don't know, 70 years or something. So what you got to do is you got to go in the basement and look for those things.
Wow. We did a lot of research, and it sounds like this was probably pretty satisfying work. It was sad to a certain degree when you found out the experience that some of your relatives had, but I bet it was fairly satisfying to be able to put this all together.
Oh, yeah. Okay. It's kind of like detective work, and right. I really enjoy it. Finding things.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, and another source that you use, David, too, is the National Archives, because the U.S. government, does a magnificent job of preserving records. And so there's a tremendous amount of information in the archives about the concentration camps and all the documents and all the sort of family records. I talked to my friend Joe Okamoto, who was in prison when he was 3 years old, and he went back to the archives and got his folder of information. And for a three-year-old, it was about an inch and a half thick of paperwork. Wow. Every dentist visit, every time he had a cold. I mean, they just documented almost everything. So there's a treasure trove of information sitting in the National Archives, and David's been able to tap into that as well. So it's just great work you're doing, David. It's really very impressive.
Mm-hmm. And that leads me to wonder, so tell us a little bit more about your family's involvement with the Smithsonian exhibit and the World War II imprisonment and the story of the dress.
So Patty Hirahara helped me get my mother's dress into the Smithsonian. Patty has, or Patty's family has, enormous Heart Mountain photo collection at WSU. And her grandfather, George, and my step-great-grandfather, Sam Megida, were buddies from Yakima. And so I was like, I had my family on Ancestry.com, and Patty contacted me because, you know, I didn't know who Patty was. And then she said, hey, I think my grandfather knew your family. So I said, okay. And then she sent me some photos of my family at Heart Mountain concentration camp. So one of them had my mother, Lois, wearing a hand-crocheted dress made by my grandmother in the concentration camp. I recognized this dress, and I said, oh, we still have that. So Noriko Sanofuji from the Smithsonian came out to our house to examine it. She accepted the dress, and it remained on display at the Righting the Wrong exhibit for about 2 years. The dress was exhibited later on a roadshow by the Smithsonian, and Noriko recently showed it to the ambassador from Japan. And that happened just like last week, so I'm kind of happy about that.
Yeah, and were you able to get out to that exhibit while it was, I'm assuming it was a special display at the American History Museum?
Yeah, I went there, and it was kind of fun because I met Noriko, and she showed me the exhibit. I kind of had like a little private tour, and then she took me to the back rooms and had someone show me ancient dental equipment, so that was kind of fun too.
Grayson.
So, yeah. So actually, I spend a lot of time with Noriko. Comes out once a year, and we get together.
Great. Also, to tell us a little bit about the paintings that were done in the camp.
The paintings, they were like, I didn't even know we had them. And my cousin Lori, you know, she took them from my aunt's basement, and then she told me, and then she said, you know, I had them for a while, so but I don't want them anymore because we're remodeling the house. So she said, you want them? So I said yes, and I got them. So they're not that big, like maybe 2 feet at most wide, and one of them is shows a longer view, and it shows all the barracks. And so there are like 8 barracks, and one would be for the cafeteria, and then down the middle there would be a restroom and a laundry room. You could see that in the painting, and then the other 8 barracks on the other side. So, and then there's a guard tower on top of the mountain you can see. So I mean, it's just kind of interesting that someone painted that.
And that was a painting of which camp?
Tule Lake.
Oh, Tule Lake down in California.
Uh-huh.
Is Tule Lake still a national park site?
It is. Yeah. It's a national park site.
Is it over?
They've preserved a couple of the buildings. At most of the concentration sites, there are basically not much left. But each one is a national park, a national historic site, and they have interpretive centers and interpretive signs at all of the concentration camps. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I know there's one in Colorado. I don't think it's quite as robust as to the one in Manzanar,
right.
And that one I think is the most robust.
Yes.
Let me follow up on something else that was said. You've talked fairly extensively about the Sakahara and the Tanaka families and a little bit about some others. Were there other individuals on Vashon that you uncovered any information about, any other families?
Okay. What I did was I made family trees for most of the Japanese people who lived on Vashon. And I was actually able to contact a few original Vashon Japanese who were kids before World War II. And some of their descendants. So Bruce and Alice talked to some of them, and they know more about that. I think Bruce, he did like an interview, right, with Sam Sakamoto.
Yes, we've done with the Voice of Vashon, we did two short films, you know, about 40-minute films, part one and part two of the Japanese Americans on Vashon, and interviewed as many people as we could. So we've got not only those two videos that are available on the Voice of Vashon site, and you can also Google them, but also we have a tremendous archive of the interviews. If in making a film, you do 2 hours of interviews and you use 5 minutes of the interview on film. But so we've got background information, and David was just a great resource in helping us locate those folks to do those interviews and to make that film.
Hmm. So I recently worked on the Vashon Mukai family and discovered some new information. I created a website called Newfound History of the Mukai Family Farm and Garden. So I can go into some of the new findings. As we know, Ben Mukai was a prosperous cultivator who established the Mukai cold processed fruit barreling plant. Ben Mukai married three times throughout his life. Two of his wives, Kuni and Sato Nakanishi, were sisters, and the third wife was Shizu Ishida. Muki and his wife Sato had a son named Masahiro, or Masa for short. Previously, it was assumed that B.D. Mukai married Sato before marrying Kuni. However, it has been proven that Sato's elder sister Kuni was his first spouse. Kuni and Mukai were wed on February 11, 1907 in San Francisco. Sato and Mukai married on March 16, 1914 in Tacoma, Washington. What I found was that Ben and Kuni Mukai were living in San Francisco, and Sato also wound up in San Francisco, and later on, the three of them moved up to Seattle. So Sato, Masa, and B.D. Mukai resided on Vashon Island during the early 1910s. Sato contracted TB around 1916. Mukai spared no expense in the construction of an air room at their residence and in the provision of medical care to extend Sato's life. In the fall of 1920, she was transferred to one of the costliest cottages at the Seattle Pulmonary Hospital. Sato Mukai passed away from TB at the Mukai residence on May Day, 1921. Mukai and Kuni remarried on February 20, 1925. In 1926, Mukai acquired 40 acres of land in his son's name. During that time, Japanese immigrants were not allowed to own land. Mukai founded a renowned fruit processing facility, as I stated before, and Kuni developed a beautiful rock garden. Numerous island visits and a 1933 feature in the Christian Science Monitor brought the rock garden to national attention. So now I'm going to talk about Masa, which is B.D. Mukai's son, and his first wife, Mamie. Mamie was born to Yosaku and Mumi Okubo in February 20, 1917. Later, she was adopted out to Tanjiro and Katsuno Kushi somewhere in the early 1920s. Tanjiro Kushi, a significant contractor in the Seattle cannery business and shoyu maker, formally announced Mamie and Masa Mukai's engagement on August 21st, 1933. Masa built a new home for his spouse after they were married, and Mamie gave birth to her son Milton in 1934. Okay. Mamie, the spouse of Masa, shot him in the early hours of Friday, September 6, 1935. The incident took place at the residence of his father, B.D. Mukai, utilizing a .32-caliber firearm. He was found in the bathroom. The bullet penetrated his torso precisely below his heart. A Vashon physician provided initial medical care. He was transported to Seattle General Hospital aboard the first ferry, where he was in critical state. Masa and Mamie were house-sitting for B.D. Mukai and Kuni while they were away in California. Masa initially said to the deputy sheriff, that He had been unintentionally shot while inspecting the firearm with his wife. Deputy Prosecutor Carl Husey questioned young Miss Mamie Mukai regarding the shooting incident. She was in tears and asserted that the firearm discharged after she and her husband toyed with it. Husey trusted Miss Mukai until he conversed with Masa at Seattle General Hospital. Masa informed the prosecutor that his wife had threatened to kill him on several occasions during the past 2 years. He asserted that his wife brandished the firearm at him during the peak of an altercation. Deputy prosecutor expressed confidence that Masa's shooting was not an accident. Mamie Mukai was arrested at the hospital on a visit to her husband and later released on $5,000 bail. She was charged with first-degree assault and later was due in court.
Wow. That's an epic story. I mean, we are digging a little deeper here. Now, that's some texture to history right there. Wow. That's an incredible story. So, and then did it resolve well? Did they remain married? Then what happened?
Okay. What happened was... Masa filed for a divorce from the hospital bed.
Good call.
He requested legal custody of his 15-month son, Milton. And when Milton was 16 months old, he got the divorce and custody.
Huh. Wow. That's a lot of heartache for one family.
Oh, man.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. But also an interesting story in that she ultimately, David, you might want to elaborate on this. She ultimately moves to California, becomes an actor, and has a small part in Around the World in 80 Days.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And then ultimately reconciles with her son, Milton. I had a chance to interview Milton several times. And she had come up to visit him. They had sort of reconciled and I think developed a warm relationship, you know, from this sort of a very violent kind of beginning. Because Milton really never knew her until he was an older adult. Another interesting part of a family story. We tend to think that families are, particularly in the 20s and 30s, are pretty stable kind of things. But, you know, in reality, families are families no matter what time. Isn't that right, David?
That's right. And, she was really young when she got married. So, and then she had a baby right away. So that could have put some stress on her. So she was only 17. And then by the time she was 19, she was on trial. So.
Wow.
Things happened quickly, huh?
Yeah.
So the verdict of the trial remains unknown.
Oh.
And Mamie, what happened was she went to Japan February 13, 1936. And then she came back to Seattle in 1939. She changed her surname back to Kushi. And as Bruce said, she... married Lee Karaki. So if we go on, Masa marries Chieko Wakatsuki on Valentine's Day, 1937. So the next big thing that happened, which you guys may not know about, is that Kuni files for divorce from B.D. Mukai in 1939, accusing him of infidelity and demanding $200 in alimony per month. Miss Mukai said in her complaint that her husband had constantly neglected her and had been spending time with another woman. In requesting alimony, she revealed that she and her husband had amassed property worth more than $60,000 and their annual net income is approximately $10,000, which is quite a bit of money back then, right?
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah, it is.
Exactly. Right.
So Kuni got the divorce, and as part of the settlement, she received a share of her husband's 60,000 agricultural holdings on Vashon Island. And Mukai did not dispute it. So Cooney, Masa, Chieko, and Milton lived in the Mukai home in 1940, which included, you know, the large farm and garden. Cooney remained single and died in April 24, 1957, in Vashon. Mm-hmm. Whereas B.D. Mukai, he married Shizu Ishida in 1940, and they moved to Arizona. And later on in 1941, they went back to Japan, and they stayed there throughout World War II. After World War II in 1948, they returned to Washington and later moved to Los Angeles. B.D. Mukai died in Osaka, Japan on May 27, 1973.
Fascinating family stories, and how complicated and nuanced these stories are. Kevin, do you want to pop in here and ask a question?
And David, thank you for recounting that. I remember my childhood and growing up with my community of friends, and including several folks of Japanese descent, which was always kind of intriguing. I know Tommy, whose last name I'm trying to recall, who could play amazing piano as a little kid. He was pretty awesome. But hey, I'm wondering, given what's going on in our government now, we talked about that a bit at the top of the show, and the, you know, what families experienced during World War II. You know, comparing that to what's happening right now with these efforts by the government to identify and deport immigrants, I'm just curious what your perspective is on what you're seeing now. Are there parallels that come to mind for you? And generally, what would you like to share with us about this new administration's policies around immigrants?
Okay. There are similarities between what happened to Japanese immigrants and citizens during World War II and what is happening now. During World War II, the War Relocation Authority was a government agency in charge of identifying and forcibly relocating people of Japanese ancestry, including both Japanese immigrants and Japanese Americans, to concentration camps across the U.S., primarily due to concerns about sabotage and espionage following the attack of Pearl Harbor. The FBI was used to round up prominent aliens. Unfortunately, the government viewed an entire population as a threat, when in reality, they were law-abiding and hardworking Japanese aliens and citizens. This led to severe financial hardships and imprisonment in concentration camps. They were left with little once they were released. So today, the same thing is happening to immigrants. Law-abiding and hardworking people are being targeted and rounded up. Japanese were forced into concentration camps, but today's immigrants are being deported. This would bring extreme financial hardships to their families. We should stop deporting immigrants who fear persecution in their home country, are law-abiding, and are hardworking.
Yes, I know there's several efforts to provide support and protection for community members who feel that they are vulnerable to that kind of work, helping make sure that paperwork is in place, people know their rights, things of that nature. So I'm encouraged to see the community moving forward to help do that. I don't know, David, if there's any other things that look from your perspective that people might consider is important right now to support our community members who may be vulnerable to that type of treatment.
I think right now I heard on news that they're trying to cut off funding to churches or other agencies that support the immigrants who can't afford food or housing. So, I mean, what are they supposed to do if they can't buy a sandwich or live somewhere. So I think they should stop defunding these projects or organizations and, you know, and help out the less fortunate people, right?
Yeah, yeah. Thanks for that feedback. I know a lot of the protests that are happening around the country right now, one of those issues is the defunding. The you know, new government efficiency group, mainly Elon Musk, is promoting. Yeah. So it's frustrating to see. And I'm, like I say, I'm really happy to see communities are coming together to oppose that kind of work. And we shall see, of course. That's what maybe Bruce is a historian. I think we have to look in the rearview mirror, you know, 10 years from now to see how things worked out. But hopefully we can prevail here.
Let's hope so. And you know, we have to remind ourselves we've been here before. Maybe not at this extreme, but we've been here before with other administrations in the past. And, you know, the American people have preserved through that and persevered. And actually the voice of the people does at some point emerge and is heard. And so the question is how that will happen here. So David, I had a question for you too. Just maybe you could, you mentioned earlier about the Densho archive, and maybe you could talk just a minute about that, because we only have 4 or 5 minutes left. But anybody who's interested in understanding the Japanese-American experience during World War II and as immigrants and as building communities, the Densho Archive is just an incredible sort of project in Seattle that well, maybe you can tell us a little bit about the Densho Archive.
Basically, are saving the history of the Japanese Americans who were incarcerated in concentration camps. So they have interviews of people that were there, and if you have photos, who like old photo albums, you can send it to them, and they will digitize them for free, and they'll be online, and then you can view them. And I think they also have like things for schoolrooms or classrooms where teachers can use the materials and they can have some kind of projects with their students. And so they're basically just preserving all that history for us.
Yeah. Yeah. And Densho is just go to densho.com, and it's an incredible archive of materials that they've been gathering together, photographs, interviews, newspaper articles. It's just an amazing way to, if you want to research or if you want to learn about Japanese American experience during World War II and before and after. I mean, it's a very broad sort of archive. So we're down to the last couple minutes here. Kevin, maybe you can tell us a little bit about what is in store for us next week.
Next week is a show where we have no guest invited. The Briefleys got together a month or so ago and said, with all the hijinks going on in the new administration, the news cycle, we want to make sure to spend some time talking about what's happening. So, you know, I wish I knew what was going to happen in the next week, but whatever it is, I would say rest assured that is going to be some topics. Amy, I do hope that, for example, we'll be able to check in on how work is being done with the ferry legislation. And, of course, I'll see you this afternoon to testify. 1923, is that the bill? Is that right?
Yeah, tomorrow, 4 o'clock tomorrow. 1923.
Okay, yeah.
Thank no, you today for, you're gonna go get chirpy with Jayapal.
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. So I'll provide some feedback on that. And thanks for letting me know what day it is, because if I didn't have a calendar, I would be lost.
I know.
Wandering around the house, wondering constantly. What do I do next.
Yeah.
So yeah, we'll see, Bruce, what comes up. But cross our fingers, we won't be reporting like Well, hopefully we'll be reporting. We're still all through doing great work to make sure to get the government we can at least, if not appreciate, at least tolerate.
I'm sure there'll be plenty to talk about next week. Well, David, let me just tell you our thanks for having you on and sharing your story. And for those that are interested, the Friends of Mukai, this Saturday, the 23rd at 2 p.m., are having a remembrance ceremony for the anniversary of the Executive Order 9066. So 2 o'clock at the Mukai Farm and Garden, there'll be a remembrance ceremony and a film about the resistance at one of the concentration camps. So put that on your calendar. And David, I just want to thank you for coming, for sharing your story, and for David, for Truman, who I hope is listening, Amy, Craig, Kevin, I'm Bruce. We thank you for listening, and we'll see you again next week on the Brown Briefly.